Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Yeah, those cat videos on YouTube are still going to be free, but some of that other stuff, maybe not. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Monday, the 6th of May. Good to have you with us. And yes, we know this is a radio program, but we're going to start with a little video today all the same. Online video, more specifically, YouTube by name. We've known this has been coming for a while, but the Financial Times reported over the weekend that the world's biggest video service is going to start charging subscription fees for some of its content, perhaps as soon as this week. It's not that charging for content in and of itself is new in video or audio. You've got your Netflix subscription probably, and maybe you pay for music on Pandora or Spotify as well. But there is no small risk for Google, which owns YouTube, in putting a price on what until now has been free. Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports.
Before you panic, let's be clear. The vast majority of YouTube videos are expected to remain free. And you know how that works, right? If I go on YouTube and want to watch this video, all I wanna get is, then I have to sit through this ad.
Nationwide is on your side.
It's an advertising model that's ripped from traditional TV. The only problem is that while sales of online video ads are growing, they're still just a $4 billion market. Clark Fredrickson is a researcher at eMarketer.
The television market is a $65 billion market.
So how does YouTube catch up? Last year, the online video giant shelled out $200 million to launch a handful of channels. Some like The Onion and Jamie Oliver's FoodTube are popular, but the word is many of the shows are expensive to produce, and they're having a hard time making money off of ads. Colin Gillis is an analyst at BGC Partners, and he says the subscription model might help.
By moving to, or at least trying to, see if there's a subscription revenue base out there that can drive more quality content, that's something that they would want to try.
Google, which owns YouTube, says subscription fees aren't a matter of if, but when. And they're only expected to apply to about 50 channels. Sameet Sinha is an analyst at B. Riley & Company. He doesn't expect subscriptions to turn off users.
More and more people are getting used to it that, you know, if we want higher quality, we have to somehow pay for it.
Sinha says Netflix and Hulu have taught users to pay. So now YouTube's challenge is to make sure that the price is right. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
The big drug company Pfizer wants you to buy more of its products. Not a story so much until you know what product and how Pfizer wants to boost those sales. In a first for the pharmaceutical industry, the company is going to sell its erectile dysfunction drug Viagra directly to patients from the company website. It's even offering a deal, 3 free pills with first order. Why, you might rightly ask, is Pfizer doing this? Well, it needs to boost its own performance. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the health desk at WHYY.
Really? Who wants to stride up to the pharmacy and order Viagra? Anyone? I didn't think so. But Pfizer's decision isn't as much about protecting a guy's pride as it's about protecting profits and fending off rivals.
Certainly Cialis is eating into shares, especially among the people who sit in bathtubs market.
Les Funtleiter is a healthcare analyst with the investment firm Polywog. Viagra's annual sales are $2 billion, a little less than half the erectile dysfunction market it created and once dominated. And Funtleiter says Pfizer's not just fighting Cialis here. There's also the knockoffs.
The other thing is you have seen significant counterfeiting.
We've all gotten the crazy emails.
Say, I can have sex all night long. Cheapest price.
Pharmaceutical analyst Rick Edmonds with Booz & Company says the move should help Pfizer distance itself from the counterfeiting and brush up its image at the same time.
got an implication well beyond just law of sales. It's got an implication around how the public views the effectiveness of products.
Edmund says it's too soon to know whether this will prop up Pfizer's sales. But to sweeten the deal, the drug maker, stealing a page from the online knockoffs, promises 30% off your second order. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
A little bit of up, a little bit of down on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. For all the complaints Americans have about our healthcare system, it could be worse. You could live in China, where forget copays and deductibles, out-of-pocket costs can run you a whole year's salary. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has been working on a series the past year or so, stories about some of the people who make the world's second biggest economy go round, people who make their living on a single street in Shanghai. It's called the Street of Eternal Happiness. Today, why it's important to stay healthy in China. Here's Rob.
It's 6 o'clock in the morning. The sun rises over a park at the eastern end of the Street of Eternal Happiness. The only signs of life are singing birds and dancing seniors. It's a ritual repeated at parks throughout China every morning, line after elderly line, dancing through morning exercises in unison. ...63-year-old Tu Dongxiu is off to the side of the group dancing on her own.
Once I begin to dance, I put all my troubles behind me. I don't have high blood pressure, diabetes, nothing. If I keep dancing, I won't ever have to see a doctor.
And that's part of the reason so many seniors like Tu return here every morning. If they don't, at some point they'll end up 5 miles due west, where the Street of Eternal Happiness ends. The only dancing here at Shanghai's Huashan Hospital is the sidestep shuffle around thousands of patients waiting to see a doctor. Patients like Yao Jinlian, who arrived here at 5 this morning from the countryside. It's now noon, and she's still waiting.
My limbs hurt, and I get migraines. Sometimes I can't even walk. I've spent more than $10,000 out of my own pocket for dozens of visits to neurologists over the past 2 years.
Like nearly all Chinese, Yao is covered by a state health insurance plan, but she's discovered that it doesn't pay for much of her treatment. Yao and her husband, Tang Jinlin, say that after 2 years in and out of hospitals, her doctors still don't know what's wrong with her.
It's useless. They're just trying to check her quickly, prescribe some drugs, and move on to the next patient. They're not trying to figure out what's really wrong with her.
We've gone through all of our retirement savings seeing these doctors.
Yao has come face to face with one of the biggest challenges of China's healthcare system. Public hospitals in China don't receive enough funding from the government, so doctors are forced to look elsewhere for money. Gordon Liu is the director of Peking University's China Center for Health Economic Research. Liu says Chinese doctors commonly supplement their incomes by prescribing drugs many patients don't need.
Mainly because the doctors are positioned as the government officers, so their salaries have not been increased comparably.
Liu says a typical doctor at a government-run hospital makes less than $1,000 US a month. Receiving kickbacks for drug sales is so widespread that it's coined a popular Chinese phrase, yi yao yang yi, feeding hospitals by selling drugs. But there are other ways Chinese doctors make extra money. Retired Communist Party official Cui Ji and his wife slowly walk out of Huashan Hospital onto the Street of Eternal Happiness. The 87-year-old Cui says it bothers him that doctors also expect traditional Chinese red envelopes stuffed with cash before they perform an operation.
Bribes like this are common. It makes us feel scared for our lives if we don't give the doctor a red envelope before surgery. Saving lives and curing diseases is a doctor's duty, not taking bribes. There's no way I'd ever give a bribe to these doctors.
As Cui says this, his wife, Long Wenjin, chuckles. She has news for him.
He doesn't know this, but the last time he got an operation, our daughter slipped the doctor a red envelope right before his surgery.
It's a type of corruption even the unwilling have a hard time escaping. So that's why many seniors opt out of China's healthcare system altogether by exercising religiously, like this group back on the opposite end of the Street of Eternal Happiness. Xu Chengyin spends his morning at the park spinning a diabolo, also known as a Chinese yo-yo, balancing it on a string held by two sticks. The 65-year-old was diagnosed with diabetes 10 years ago. He's run out of money to pay the medical bills, so he comes here each day to try and stay as healthy as he can.
All of us here must exercise. We simply can't afford a hospital visit. Our retirement salaries are just a few $100s a month. Once you get ill, you're finished.
Rather than counting his days left, says Xu, he'd rather be here, counting along with the morning exercise routine alongside dozens of others on the Street of Eternal Happiness. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The rest of the stories in Rob's series are online. Pictures, an interactive map, the whole smash. Check it out, marketplace.org. All right, it's time for a little question and answer session as a way into this next story. You guys ready for this? All right, here we go. Who can turn the world on with her smile? Who can take a nothing day and suddenly make it all seem worth my life? I'm sorry, I didn't want to laugh, but I just couldn't help it. You get where I'm going with this, right? Mary Tyler Moore, or more accurately, Mary Richards. She and the rest of the gang from the WJM newsroom and the real-life people behind the Mary Tyler Moore Show are the subjects of a new book by Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong. It's called Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted. Jennifer, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
What was it about this show that, and I know I realize you've written a whole book on what it was about this show.
Right.
But there was a little something that made this show different for its time, right?
Absolutely. There's a couple different things, I think, actually. I mean, the character of Mary Richards is the first kind of really independent single woman. She's 30, unapologetically single on television. You know, we think of this as the single woman show, right, that brought us things like Sex and the City later and The Mindy Project Now or Girls. And I think that it was a little bit different, a type of comedy than people had seen before. I mean, CBS didn't know what to make of it at first. Right. They were like, what is this? This isn't funny. But it really hit home with viewers. And I think that's because they fell in love with the characters and they wanted to follow them.
Am I a bad person if I say that I never really liked Rhoda?
Would I spend an entire month's salary on brand new carpeting for you? I don't know you. I never saw you before. That's for me. I did it.
I don't think you're a bad person. Okay. I may not like you anymore. No, actually, I mean, it's funny you should say that because a lot of the audience testing early on was that people did not like her at all. And I mean, I think a lot of women in particular tend to like almost identify themselves as a Mary or a Rhoda.
Oh, wow.
They're very different types. So maybe if you felt particularly fond of Mary, you might have felt a little, especially at the beginning when they were clashing a little bit, you might have felt a little protective of her.
Is it too much to say that this show saved Mary Tyler Moore's career?
I don't think it is. I mean, I think she would probably say the same thing. She was in precarious territory right before this. It was kind of one of those things. It's tough to make good after you've been on a huge hit show and she was on the Dick Van Dyke Show. So if this show had gone off the rails at any point and it looked like it was going to several times, it would have been really upsetting for her. I mean, when they had one disastrous early kind of pre-taping, she cried afterwards because it was so bad. And she thought, oh, my God, this thing's going down the tubes with my name on it. And she didn't know what she was going to do next.
And yet Mary Tyler Moore Productions, the production house that she forms, goes on to do Hill Street Blues, St. Elsewhere, a whole bunch of, you know, 1980s era shows that, while certainly not, you know, crazy successful, did all right.
Absolutely. I mean, they were really known after the show as sort of a writer's haven. You know, they called it Camelot because Grant Tinker was in charge and he was very much into fostering creativity. You know, he always was encouraging his writer producers to take chances. And his whole deal was mainly to sort of run interference with the network and protect his creative teams at all costs. And that seemed to really, really work for a while. I mean, they were a huge force in the, you know, throughout the 70s and early 80s in television.
The thing that kind of amazed me reading the early days of the Mary Tyler Moore Show was the extent of network meddling, right? The bosses in New York getting a hold of somebody out in L.A. and saying, you can't do this, you can't do that, you got to do this and you got to do that. Has that changed, do you think, since 1970, 72?
There's always meddling, don't get me wrong. I've heard many, many stories in, you know, my coverage of current shows that this still goes on all the time. It's nerve-wracking. They put a lot of money into it. It's a huge commitment for the networks, and they're always very nervous. But some of them even are going the other way now, where they're telling them, put more in, you know, put more sex and violence and edginess and whatever, that sort of thing in, because they want to get the attention.
Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong, her book is called Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted. It's about the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Jennifer, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
There's two ways you can make money on gold. You either trade it, or you can actually get into production.
We went with production, but first, let's do the numbers. This was a mixed-up day for the markets. The Dow Industrials gave back a fraction of 1%, just 5 points, closed at 14,968, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ picked up 4-tenths, 14 points, finished at 3,392. The S&P 500 added 2-tenths of 1%. That's 3 points. Another record close there, ended at 1617. Financial firms, though, knew only one direction. Bank of America shares soared more than 5% after settling a dispute over bad mortgages. Morgan Stanley ticked up 2.2%. Goldman Sachs lifted 2%. JPMorgan Chase deposited 1.2%. Citigroup added 1% to round things out for financials. Tech stocks, however, were not of one mind. Apple climbed 2.3% after a big investment firm boosted its price target for the stock. And Google clicked up nearly 2% on that YouTube news we told you about. But Adobe Systems was off more than 1% today. Tyson Foods had a beef with, yes, beef in the second quarter. Seems consumers were eating less high-priced red meat and more chicken. That drove down earnings. It took 3% off its stock price. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.76%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve is scheduled to report on consumer credit for March. In Las Vegas, the National Hardware Show gets underway. Everything from hammers to hoses and hordes of other stuff I'm not familiar with. And pack an extra apple for your kid to take to school. It's National Teacher Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The upfronts are very nearly upon us. That time of year when cable and network television companies roll out their fall lineups and get advertisers to spend a whole lot of money to buy commercials on those shows. And there is one storyline out there already. Comedy is king. USA Network has paid more than $1 million an episode, $1 million per episode, to air reruns of the ABC hit Modern Family. No small risk for a cable channel better known for dramas. And not for nothing, it's a bet on a sitcom that doesn't have a laugh track. As corny and superficial as that may sound, laugh tracks make a difference. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
Most TV shows used to be filmed in front of a live audience, so viewers could hear the crowd's reaction. The laugh track was born in 1950 to mimic that experience, or enhance the audience reaction, says Tom Adams with IHS Electronics and Media.
A guy named Charlie Douglas invented a machine that was kind of like a big pipe organ with pedals and dials and stuff.
I'm your Vitamita Benjamin girl. Are you tired, run down, listless? Do you poop out at parties?
It was meant to communicate that sense of community and theatrical experience. People enjoyed shows more where there was some laughter going on.
Tim Brooks is a former network executive and a TV historian. He says laugh tracks might sound old-fashioned, but we like an old-fashioned laugh track. And the proof is in the ratings.
The biggest hit comedies are shows like Two and a Half Men and Big Bang Theory. Those have laugh tracks.
There are hit comedies that don't do laugh tracks. Brooks says those usually have a subtler humor and a smaller audience, like Arrested Development or The Office. But even for those shows, people crave that community experience, says Brooks, and networks are looking for different ways to create it. ABC has developed an app where viewers can share their reactions live through Facebook.
You have 5 sentiments to choose from.
Maya Buratz developed the Social Sound Tracker app for ABC.
We have a laugh button, we have a boo button, we have an awe button, we have a gasp button.
TV historian Tim Brooks says laugh tracks will stick around in some form or another because we do want that sense of community and togetherness, even if we just want to be alone with our TV. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The price of an ounce of gold in New York held basically steady today, which, the way gold prices have been going of late, should probably count as a win. The shiny yellow stuff is at 2-year lows, right near $1,470 an ounce. Still, though, for some, the thing that's attractive about gold isn't what it's worth. It's the going out and getting it that makes it special. So we went out and tried to get us some, the way they used to do it, with a guy named Martin Miles.
Why don't you tell us where we are, actually?
Okay, we're at the East Fork of the San Gabriel River, and we're using our gold pans to recreate what the old-timers were doing 150 years ago. The first step is front panning.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
And
all right, aren't you worried? I mean, that's a lot of stuff going out of that pan. You're not worried that you're...
No, not at all.
Okay, I am.
Yeah.
That's my fortune you're rinsing away there, man.
You slow down at the end. Like that.
I've totally...
Hi, are you sure you never did this before?
Aw, shucks.
I think he can make some money. This is where El Doradoville sprang up in 1859.
What was El Doradoville?
El Doradoville...
It sounds like this idealistic place of gold and adventure.
Yeah, it was like mostly saloons and a few stores.
So some adventure.
And a lot of folks driven by a common purpose. To get as much as they could.
They were looking for gold.
Yes. A flood came 3 years later and wiped out the city. And there are still remnants that you can find from time to time that'll burble up to the surface.
What amazes me about this, actually, is how low-tech it is. I mean, we're living here in the 21st century where I can pick up my cell phone and find almost anything. If those guys from El Doradoville up around a bend in the river... If they came back and saw us standing here, would they recognize what we're doing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they would. They'd wonder about plastic that hadn't been invented yet.
Is this a money-making enterprise today? Can you make a living?
There's two ways you can make money on gold. One is by starting out as a billionaire, and you become a millionaire very quickly. But mostly you either trade it or you can actually get into production. But it's no longer a one-man operation. It's now you need a corporation,
yeah.
You need funding, scope, et cetera, et cetera. A little guy, somebody like me, we're known as small-scale miners.
Yeah.
And usually it's not our primary means of income.
I have to ask about your gold tooth.
You're
not quite of the age where that was standard dentistry, so I imagine that's on purpose.
No, thank my grandfather for that. He had a gold tooth. He was my favorite person in the world. He had a gold tooth, and by golly, when I needed a cap, I got a gold tooth.
Is there, do you think, a correlation between the modern search that we know and this enterprise in nature?
Well, sure. As I understand search, and I'm not a gearhead when it comes to the Internet at all, but as I understand the searches, there's ways of filtering stuff out. So it's kind of like that with the gold. What we did is we used classifiers to... get down to the values. Then at the end of the day, we've got that little concentration that is what we've been working toward. And I suppose using the Internet's the same way.
It's that first response on Google, right? That first response, yeah. It's actually backwards, right? The first response on Google is the result of all the filtering, whereas here, you have all the filtering, and then at the end, you get this little piece of whatever it is in your pan.
Oh, and it shines up at you and smiles, this golden smile. You remember that, yeah.
When you come out here on the river, whether it's with us or just to pass a Tuesday afternoon, what are you actually looking for?
Well, in my case, personally, it's an end in itself. It's just simply the experience of using all of my skills and all of my cleverness that I can muster to defeat the powers of Mother Nature, who's very good at hiding these things, these little flakes and these little nuggets. And so it's a contest between me and Mama. And at the end of the day, if I come back with a little bit, you know, I could feel pretty good about that.
That was me and Martin Milas a week or two ago on the East Fork of the San Gabriel River. It's about an hour or so north of downtown L.A. He is the president of the Prospectors Club of Southern California. That's why we went with him. Just for the record, by the way, didn't find a thing in my pans except rocks. We've got some pictures on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we get another positive economic indicator to add to last Friday's jobs report, it comes to us courtesy of the American Gaming Association, which in its annual report out today said consumer spending at commercial casinos was up almost 5% last year to just over $37 billion. And yes, gambling and its ills are well known, but if people at least feel like they've got money to burn, it's got to be a good thing, right? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow gave back a fraction of 1%, about 5 points. The NASDAQ picked up 0.4%. That is 14 points. The S&P 500 added 0.2%, 2 points on that particular index. Our producers include Lana Anwar, Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you, tomorrow. Mm-hmm. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.